Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Real Love podcast series, right here on the Sharon Salzberg Metta Hour. This series features a variety of conversations with some of the world's finest teachers and thinkers, all exploring Sharon's new book, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection. Real Love is a field guide for anyone seeking awakened living in the 21st century. To get your copy of Real Love, visit SharonSalzberg.com. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please visit www.BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and my guest today is Tim DeChristopher. Tim and I met last year when we did an event together at the Rubin Museum, and I was really impressed with him and his approach to life and climate activism. And I felt like I learned a lot, and it was a fantastic kind of meeting, so I wanted to invite him to be part of this podcast series for Real Love. So Tim is a climate activist and co-founder of the environmental group Peaceful Uprising. In December of 2008, Tim disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction by registering as bidder 70 and outbidding oil companies for land parcels in national parks in Utah. For this act of civil disobedience, Tim was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison, of which he served a total of 21 months. Upon receiving his sentence, Tim released the following statement: "You can steer my commitment to a healthy and just world if you agree with it, but you can't kill it. This is not going away. At this point of unimaginable threats on the horizon, this is what hope looks like. In these times of a morally bankrupt government that has sold out its principles, this is what patriotism looks like. With countless lives on the line, this is what love looks like, and it will only grow. Tim was released from prison on April 21st, 2013, studied at Harvard Divinity School, and continues to work to spread the urgency of the climate crisis and the need for bold, confrontational action in order to create a just and healthy world. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so glad to see you again.
Me too.
So that was an amazing statement you made after your release.
Oh, thank you.
It was very moving. And can you talk a little bit about what that period of time was for you?
It was a challenging period of time. And actually, when I look back on that period of time before I got locked up, now mostly what I think about was how dysfunctional it was on a personal level. Because I was so focused on the work that I was doing. And so I was causing a lot of destruction in my personal relationships at the time. So it's interesting to see sort of the love and the passion and the care that I poured into statements like that.
Yeah.
When I was kind of neglecting the people that were around me at the same time. But yeah, that statement in my sentencing hearing was the first time in the whole court process of 2.5 years that I was able to speak openly in the court, and so there was a lot that had built up, and it was kind of the first chance that I had to really explain myself because I was so restricted during the trial when the jury was in the room. I wanted to fully explain myself, and it felt it felt like this was my moment to exist in history, sort of.
Oh, I think you really do. I followed you obviously long before I met you, and was very felt very involved. I contributed to your defense fund, you know. I was like, you know, you're kind of in my mind and my heart, certainly, and I would think about you. And as I told you that night at the Ribbon, I was very upset when you went to prison.
Yeah. I think there was a lot of that sentiment that a lot of people that I had never met really made an emotional connection there. You know, which is always interesting when I meet those folks. And they're like, "Oh, I feel like I know you so much."
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think that's also kind of part of the value of civil disobedience, and the critical importance of being open when we put ourselves in positions like that and telling our story, and it sort of allows people to make that personal connection.
Yeah.
You know, one of the big ongoing arguments that I've had with a section of the climate movement for the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or so, has been about wearing masks when people do an action. And, you know, we saw a lot of that like in Standing Rock and in other places. And I've always argued that it really hinders the ability to build a movement and to allow people to connect with us on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the way that movements really grow, and the way that people are empowered.
I think that's really true. And it's sort of like, I know it must be confounding because people like me, of course, I didn't know you at all, you know, on one level. And yet, you know, as a symbol or representative of an action and somebody who, I mean, I don't know your particular issues or traumas or, you know, what you had to overcome to do that. I know a little bit, I think, what I would have to overcome, you know, and so, of course, that got highlighted in a good way. You know, like I know for myself, for example, in a time when it feels like the news we're getting and the kind of official statements are duplicitous, you know, it brings up a tremendous amount for me about, a childhood full of secrets, for example. And so it's the one thing mm-hmm. that I have the most challenge dealing with, you know, not being told the truth and not just having it out there. And, you know, and so I see kind of the range of my reactions, and I know I have to acknowledge those reactions before I go through it, you know, and go forward. And so I'm sure it's like something is there for everybody, whatever it is. And just knowing that there must be is kind of encouraging.
Yeah. And, you know, and some of that we sort of have to acknowledge and overcome, you know, that the ways in which that can be destructive. But there's also a lot of opportunity in the way that that works of the power of our empathy when we are in a way experiencing what the other person is experiencing. You know, and the more we learn about neuroscience and how mirror neurons work and things like that, you know, it's in some ways we really are experiencing, mental mm-hmm. level, we are mm-hmm. having the same experience and it's changing our brain. Mm-hmm. And so when we're connecting with someone who is doing something powerful, it's sort of a practice for ourselves to be able to step into that role as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. It's like one of my friends used to say one of the things he found really confounding about life was that nobody, for example, maybe could run a 4-minute mile, and then suddenly somebody runs, one person runs a 4-minute mile, suddenly a lot of people can run a 4-minute mile.
Yeah.
You know, it's what it takes. It really does take that.
Right. Yeah, it really opens up the boundaries of possibility.
Yeah.
You know, but the scary thing is that works in both directions. Yeah. You know, that like, you know, it used to be inappropriate to say a lot of things in public and express a lot of bigotries and hateful rhetoric and that sort of thing. And then, you know, one public persona breaks those boundaries and all of a sudden it can unleash a huge amount of hatred into our society. And so, you know, it's something that we need to be very conscious of what kind of boundaries we're opening up.
That's really fascinating. So that also brings me to the question of love, you know, however forceful the action, being motivated by a feeling of love maybe also opens up those boundaries and sort of, even if it's not explicit, somehow in one's demeanor or being, you know, and to be coming from that place, maybe also opens up the possibility for others that they could be motivated not so much by hatred, you know, or rancor, but by love.
Right. Yeah, and I think for me, sort of one of the social struggles that we engage in doing this kind of work is demonstrating the strength and the power that comes from acting out of love, because it's so easily in our popular culture to think of love as this kind of soft sentimentality or as weakness, and to think that the real force and power and strength in the world is embodied in either some kind of stoicism or sort of like outright hatred or Machiavellianism or something like that. So, you know, I think it's not only important to act out of love, but to demonstrate that that acting out of love can be powerful, can be bold, can be confrontational.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Because, I mean, it's in one way, I think, part of the ways, even though they don't often go together in popular thinking, I think meditation and action can really go together, because there's something about that introspection and coming up against questions like, what really makes me happy? You know, what have I been taught? What have I been told? What myths have been propagated? But what really makes me happy? And what is strength, actually, is all this sort of bitterness and hatred and vengefulness. And is it that strong, really? And what is the toll of anger? You know, there's the positive side, perhaps, of anger, of the energy. But what toll is it taking on me or my relationships? Or you know, and so we get the chance to see for ourselves, not something we've been fed or taught. And that's, I think, an incredible strength because, of course, you're right. I mean, so much of my work is in loving kindness meditation. And so I hear that all the time, like, I don't know about that, you know. Then I end up a doormat and I end up just sort of sloppy, sentimental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, for me, the anger and love have always been intertwined, you know, and I've never really felt that they were opposite ends mm-hmm. of a dichotomy. And, you know, one of the things that I was most inspired by in divinity school was Beverly Harrison and her work, The Power of Anger in the Work of Love, which talks about the ways that anger and love are mutually supportive. And even at the time when I was disrupting the auction, I saw the way that those kind of emotions intermingled with one another, because the only other person in the auction room that I knew, that I recognized, was a woman from my church who was sitting on the other side of the room and towards the back. And as things were developing, I watched her start to cry, and first softly, but then really start crying pretty heavily. And I knew what was going on for her. I knew that just the coldness and the inhumanity of what was happening was so saddening to her. And I could sense that what I was turning outward and feeling as anger of how outrageous that coldness and that inhumanity of this process were, she was turning inward and experiencing as sadness. But the depth of her emotion that she openly expressed in that way, in a lot of ways, justified the depth of emotion that I was feeling, even though it was manifesting differently within me. It gave me the sense that, oh, I'm not crazy here for feeling this strong emotion at what's going on here, that mm-hmm. that this is not okay. And so her vulnerability in expressing that emotion, you know, that a lot of people would say, you know, oh, it's useless to just, like, you know, express your sadness in public and cry in that way. You know, like, oh, you're not doing anything, you're just crying about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what she was feeling was authentic. It was the truth. And mm-hmm. by expressing it, she emboldened others to share their truth as well, and reminded us that we're not alone. And so I think that's a really powerful and important thing to do. To honor those strong emotions, even if they're considered inappropriate at the time, whether that's the powerful love that we feel, the sadness that we feel, the anger that we feel, those are coming from somewhere real, and definitely need to be acknowledged.
Yeah, I mean, even in Buddhist teaching, you know, in the Buddhist psychology, when they talk about anger, it's the positive part is that energy, you know, mm-hmm. it's like sheer energy, which keeps us from being complacent or passive and helps us draw boundaries, helps us look deeper. It's the way sometimes it's, I often say sometimes it's the angriest person in the room who's the most truthful.
Mm.
Like it's saying, look at that problem over there that no one else wants to look at.
But
it's also said in the Buddhist psychology that anger is likened to a forest fire, which can burn up its own support, so it can devastate us and can damage us. And like a forest fire, it can burn really wild so that we might end up in a place very far from where we want to be, you know? So
mm-hmm.
One of the characteristics of not feeling anger, because we feel what we feel, I completely agree with you. It's authentic. It's what's happening. But being lost in it so much that
right.
it's determining our choices. If that's what happens, that it's in a way defining us, then usually there's a lot of tunnel vision and anger. We see very few options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you think about the last time you were really, really angry at yourself, it's not a time usually where you think, you know, I said that stupid thing, but I did five great things the same morning, you know? Those five great things are gone.
Right.
You know, so it's that collapse that's really a huge problem, mm-hmm. as well as the potential for the kind of inner devastation. So the challenge seems to be, how do you capture that energy?
Right.
Without being so defined by it.
Well, you know, for me, I feel like from the outside, I was really defined by that kind of energy in my public role in the climate movement. And a lot of the climate movement looked at me as like, you know, not necessarily the anger guy, but definitely like the civil disobedience guy, the confrontation guy. And wanted me to play that role of, you know, the angry, inflammatory rhetoric kind of speeches at rallies and that sort of thing. And I'm good at that. And sometimes I do feel that, but it's not always, it's not always what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. But for me, you know, I wasn't defining, my own action primarily as coming out of anger. What I felt right afterwards, was that it was coming out of integrity, that, what I recognized pretty shortly after that action was that was for me a moment of really intense connection with my authentic self. I felt like that action, grew out of something really deep within me. And at that time in my life, I wasn't spending a whole lot of time or intention on self-reflection and getting to know myself on that level. And so I think of that moment as sort of like a moment of grace where I sort of stumbled into that integrity and connection with my true self. But realizing that powerful moment grew out of that moment of kind of the grace of integrity there, made me realize that in order to hold on to that, that I had to be intentional about cultivating that connection with my authentic self. You know, and so for me, it wasn't necessarily a timeline of like, first I have to get to know myself on really authentically. You know, I sort of stumbled into the action first and then had to build up the structure for it.
So my mirror neurons are really firing because, of course, my path was the opposite.
Yeah. So I think that difference between just defining something as the anger versus defining something as the integrity of honoring what we're deeply feeling is the critical difference and the way that we can avoid falling into that idolization of anger.
Mm-hmm. So was that feeling of wanting to continue or deepen that connection what led to divinity school? Is that what happened?
I don't know.
Because I was following you, and yeah. I looked at that and I thought, whoa, that's interesting too, you know, divinity school.
Yeah, that came from a few different directions. You know, and the first thing that kind of brought it into my mind was a little more pragmatic, that I was in the period before I got locked up, in that 2.5 years when I was kind of operating as a full-time activist and traveling around and kind of realizing that I was good at some of this work that I had stumbled into. I looked around and thought like, okay, how can I continue doing this work? And I looked at professional activists that were working for nonprofits and NGOs and things, and I thought, they're not doing the same work that I'm doing. This is something very different. And when I looked around, I realized that the person who seemed to be the closest to doing what the kind of work that I felt like I was doing, the kind of work that I felt like I was called to do, was my minister in Salt Lake City, Tom Goldsmith. And that was kind of surprising to me to realize that. And that's the first time I kind of took that path seriously. And so that's what got me started thinking about it. And then that was also kind of happening at the same time that that I was realizing that the challenge for the climate movement was shifting. And, you know, this was in the 2010, 2011 time after the failures of Copenhagen and that sort of thing, when it became increasingly clear that we're not going to stop climate change. And so I was seeing that the challenge for our movement was shifting from being primarily about reducing emissions to being at least as much about figuring out how we can maintain our humanity in this period of really chaotic change that's largely inevitable. And looking around our movement at that time, we didn't have any of the tools and skills to even begin having that conversation about how we hold on to hope in desperate times, about how we hold on to our values and our humanity in major disruption and chaos. But I felt like the religious traditions of the world did have a set of tools and skills for that, because those are the times in people's lives when they turn to religion the strongest. And so I felt like there was something there that could teach us a lot about this time period that we're entering into.
I just spent some time in California with a Tibetan teacher of mine, Sonny Rinpoche, and he said something, and I greeted it with, like, I guess I doubled over with laughter, you know, because he looked at me like, whoa. He said something like, in Tibet we have a saying, you should build a latrine before you get the diarrhea, you know, which I just thought was the funniest thing. But of course, we don't often do that, you know, we wait for the crisis, or the bottom has to fall out because we're just happily going our way, you know?
Right. You know, and in the case of climate change, that can be really destabilizing. You know, it makes sense for the latrine, you know, but when it becomes something like what happened in Pakistan about a year ago, when they had their second really intense heat wave coming, and they started digging mass graves in anticipation of this heat wave that was being forecast, because the year before they had had thousands of bodies with nothing to do with them. And so they dug anticipatory mass graves. And reading that news just really rattled me, even as somebody who pays close attention to this stuff. That news just sort of shook me on a different level, that there was something really significant about entering that era of anticipatory mass graves.
Yeah.
And you know, and it led to me then organizing an action up in Boston with some activists that I work with up there who were fighting a pipeline, the West Roxbury natural gas pipeline that was going through Boston. And seeing the pictures from Pakistan of this long trench they were digging as a mass grave, it looked just like the trench that they were digging through Boston for this pipeline. And so we ended up doing an action in which we took over that construction site and laid down in that pipeline in the same way the bodies were laid in that trench in Pakistan, and had some local clergy and religious leaders there who were practicing their mass grave eulogies. And we were trying to kind of connect the dots between these trenches that we're digging here for more fossil fuel infrastructure and the trenches that will be dug in other places for mass graves from climate change.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it sort of harkened back to Gilgamesh of digging your own grave.
Yeah.
which is I think perhaps a useful exercise.
Well, it's always a useful exercise, yeah. I think, you know, and, you know, but it's so difficult to hang in there with uncomfortable feeling, right? I mean, there's a reason why not everybody knows what happened in Pakistan, right? And doesn't seek out that knowledge. You know, if it's not readily available, it's like, I don't think that's how I'm going to spend my evening, you know, it's like looking for that. And also to be able to sit with that and not go into one of the kind of immediate reactions of like, it's not true, or they should have built a different infrastructure, or there's nothing to do with me, or that's them, you know, it'll never like be anywhere but there.
Right.
I didn't like Pakistan anyway when I went through it, you know, like whatever, you know, and to realize that it's not just them, that's us. And that, I mean, this is one of the ways love is really defined, which you also talk about somewhere, about its interconnection. It's this acknowledgement that there's no nice dividing line, you know, that says, well, it's going to happen over there. Right. Well, I continue to have, you know, three cars or whatever it is over here.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's that ability to connect with empathy for folks that are not right in front of us that is so key to acting ethically in our complicated world, you know. And for us now, I think the big growth period for us as a species is being able not just to connect with the way we impact people on the other side of the world, but to see the way we impact people who are not even born yet. Mm-hmm. And to be able to have a relationship with future generations and connect empathically with them so that we are sort of broadening our felt experience beyond just the realm of ourself and beyond just our time, and we're sort of looking back on ourselves through their eyes.
So how do you get over like this kind of this centrality? Well, it's like privilege, really. You know, it's like feeling my experience is the experience, and everything else is kind of happening on the margins. And you know, it's like how does one develop that empathy? In other words, so that it's truly inclusive. You know, like. Through introspection, because you know yourself better, I think, and then you kind of recognize yourself in others and through, I guess, awareness, sensitivity. Like, how does that education happen? Because,
I don't know. I mean, I think it happens very different for different people, you know. And I think from an early age, it develops as an ability to see how our actions impact others. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and I think there are very positive pathways mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. that people can develop that of seeing, oh, when I do this nice thing for this other person, you know, they react in this way. And then when they react that way, it makes me feel better.
Yeah.
You know, I know that there are people who have developed it in that way. You know, unfortunately, my path was not that, and I'd say I developed that understanding through negative actions, and seeing how my actions when I was younger hurt other people, and then seeing their pain and experiencing their pain through empathy, and saying, oh, this is awful.
Yeah, yeah.
I really have the ability to hurt people. And that to me was a really critical realization that I am a danger to others. And I think it's critical to being an ethical person is mm-hmm. is recognizing that we have the ability to hurt others. We are a danger.
Mm-hmm. I don't see this negative, actually. I mean, it just seems like it's so true and kind of beautiful, you know, like, because I think the root of that is being able to recognize your own pain. It's like the reason we kind of, you know, have that sense of empathy with somebody we just lied to, for example, and is because we can be in touch with the devastation of being lied to ourselves, you know, and mm-hmm. we kind of almost recollect it, I think, in our bodies. And then we think, oh, I don't want to go there. You know, like, I don't want to visit that upon someone else. That really hurt. But if you're really cut off, you don't feel that. And so the ways we act toward others, it has no grounding in our own self-awareness in a way.
Yeah. And I think it's really easy to get caught in the trap of shame,
yeah.
where once we start thinking of ourselves as a fundamentally bad person, then we think we deserve to be disconnected. We think we're unlovable, and so we make that happen. And you know, and we hurt those people around us. And I think we're still feeling with empathy that person's pain. You know, that it causes us pain when we hurt other people. But once we're in that cycle of shame, you know, we think we deserved that pain that we get back through empathy.
Yeah.
And it's very, very difficult, I think, to take the initiative to break oneself out of the cycle of shame, because it tells us about our own identity, that we are incapable of anything else, that we are defined by those wrong actions. And so I think it almost always has to be sort of an act of grace that breaks through that from the outside, whether that's from another caring person or whether that's from God, mm-hmm. that breaks in and shows us that we are loved despite what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, of course, is so central to my kind of main work, you know, around loving kindness. And, mm-hmm. and that I think it is the opening to just that some people, you know, will call it basic goodness, but it's sort of like an essential all rightness, you know, like integrity, mm-hmm. Which we mar and we blow and we, you know, make mistakes and we do all kinds of things with. And this is a very beautiful saying from the Buddha, which is something like, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in that recollection of the harm we have created, we do feel that lack of love. But we don't, if we get stuck there, then we're just stuck. You know, that's it. And we are capable of so much more. Mm-hmm. People sometimes say, how do you have compassion for this person who you think is dreadful, you know, is doing these terrible things. And I think it's a complex question. It's a complex answer, which I'll ask you that question. But, you know, for me, it's partly understanding compassion isn't weakness. You know, it's not right. saying like, oh, you poor thing, keep going. You know, like it can be the source of great strength. And partly it's feeling we are capable of so much more, each of us, and that to see somebody dedicate their lives to kind of hurting others or being so alone and so kind of invulnerable, you know, untouched. And or to what you said earlier was really fascinating, that to lack that link between our actions and their consequences, which is a very big lack, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, to live in that way as though what we did didn't matter. And those are really problematic states, and they're kind of worthy of a sort of compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and in terms of having compassion for those who are doing something genuinely wrong, that we really object to, you know, I think part of what's complicated there is that the act of having compassion and really loving someone who's in that position of shame, actually, I think, frees them up to then have guilt for what they're doing wrong. You know, that there's in that division between guilt and shame, guilt is focused on an action, on what we did wrong, mm-hmm. whereas shame is focused on ourselves, our identity, and tells us that we're a wrong person. But I think in order to have guilt for our actions, we need to sort of turn and look at that action and say that action over there was wrong. But when shame internalizes that action and says, well, that's just who I am, we're not able to ever confront that action and have any sort of accountability for what went wrong. And so I actually think even for someone who, you know, is doing really unjust things, that act of compassion for that person is still necessary. But of course, it's very difficult when you're the one who has been harmed. And I think that's where a community of compassion is really critical. And trusting that, you know, in the cases where we have been traumatized by someone, that that we might not need to beat ourselves up for not having compassion, not being the one who liberates that person from their shame, and trusting that there can be others out there who can step in. And I think that's the wonderful thing about grace as opposed to forgiveness, is that grace doesn't have to be done by the person who was wronged, where I think forgiveness does. And so I think part of being in solidarity with people who have been hurt and have been traumatized, for me, you know, is not standing with them with hatred for that person who did this wrong thing. But I think in a lot of cases it can be actually offering grace and compassion to the person who did something wrong, to liberate that person who was traumatized, to just deal with themselves and not have to have any responsibility for that person who did something to them.
Yeah, that's really beautifully said. The way I've more awkwardly said it, or thought it, actually. I don't know if I've ever said it. When people have said, you know, I don't think I can forgive this being who hurt my family so terribly, or, you know, and I think, I don't know that that's your job, actually, you know. Like, you have a job of grieving, or, you know, like, your work is, that's a bridge too far, you know, like, because then it's just imaginary, it's just a story.
Right.
Like, oh, I must do this, you know, and not that it's not possible, but, you know, I really do believe it is possible, but not as a kind of fanciful, idealistic pressure, you know,
right. Like, yeah.
But yeah. That's a beautiful sort of expansion of it, you know, like it's someone else's job, you know, like.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I think for people of a certain Christian theology, they've had that sort of psychological ease with allowing themselves to say, well, God will you know, it's up to God to forgive or to offer grace for that person. And, you know, and I think that is true, but, you know, that same Christian Bible tells us to be imitators of God.
Yeah.
And I strongly believe that we have that spark of divinity within each of us that gives us the ability to offer that grace to one another as well. And there's certainly a lot of need for it in the world. And so I think that ability gives us the responsibility to offer it as well.
So is that how we love our enemies? Through that?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's an impossible standard, particularly when you're the one who has been hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can be a huge effort just to restrain yourself from vengeance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if you're still harboring a lot of resentment or hatred in your heart, for that person, just to restrain your hand from vengeance can be critical, and then just trusting that that others can be offering grace while you're just healing yourself. I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the essential gap, and it's something maybe we don't give ourselves enough credit for either. In that, as I'm often saying to people, you know, the gap between what you're feeling and how you're acting is really the most important cultivation, you know, at least in the beginning, because you may have that resentment in your heart, but to be devoting yourself, your days to vengeance, you know, to vengeful acts is another whole thing, you know, and that's a huge step to really have that kind of commitment to creating kind of good in this world and also honoring our feelings, you know, not pretending we don't feel what we feel, but saying, you know, I know where that path leads. I'm not gonna let that determine my choices and my actions, because it will limit me, you know, it'll diminish me and harm not only that person but me as well. And so it's almost out of compassion for yourself. You say, well, I'm not going there, you know.
Right. Yeah. And you know, and I think that's one of those situations where that gap between our feelings and our action can be acknowledged and recognized, and we say, I see that gap, and for now I'm just going to fake it. I'm just going to act like I need to act here, and for me that's how it is with a lot of courageous action as well. That you know, I think courage is one of those areas where faking it is good enough. Like, even if you don't feel courageous at the moment, you can look at a situation and say, well, this is what I would do if I was courageous, and so I'll just act like it right now. I'll fake it.
Good job. That is really a good job. So if you were going to use another word besides love, which is so squishy a word sometimes, what would you say? I say connection, you know, just to give you a hint, you know, just kind of a sense of true connection.
Yeah. I mean, for me, love is a very all-encompassing term. And so there are aspects of it that that I use other terms for in various ways. And sometimes that's connection. A lot of times it's gratitude, and in my mind, related to that is sort of like honesty or integrity. That I think a lot of times acting out of love means having integrity and honoring our gratitude, like recognizing the gifts that we have received, and the gratitude that we have for our lives and those around us. And the only way to honestly express that gratitude is through caring action of taking care of the world and the others around us that we are so grateful for.
That's fantastic. And I think in a way that ties it all together, because I often quote, I often tell the story about this time I went to Walter Reed Army Hospital. It was Nurses Week. It was National or International Nurses Week. And so there were all these kind of offerings and classes and things like that. So obviously it was teaching meditation. So, but I had a friend who was a nurse there. So before I did the talk, she gave me a tour, or, you know, short tour of one of the wards. And it was, you know, as you might imagine or know, you know, it's extremely intense. It was like between the soldiers who'd been wounded and their families, you know, and it was really, really intense. And we finished the tour, and then my friend, who was a nurse there, she turned around and said to me, the nurses who can stay here, so that, of course, means the ones who can continue to serve, right? The nurses who can stay here are not the ones who get lost in sorrow. The nurses who can stay here are the ones who can connect to the resilience of the human spirit. Yeah. And that kind of redefined compassion for me, you know, in that moment. I thought, oh, right. And I thought about, you know, the music in the civil rights era, or, you know, around your trial, you know, like, you know, I'm just reading, you had thousands of people singing in the streets and outside the courthouse, especially in the most stressful moments. So here's a quote from you. Singing together literally brings us into harmony and reminds us that we are part of something much bigger than ourselves.
Yeah. You know, and actually one of the people who wrote one of the songs that we sang a lot outside of the trial that became central to that, Brian Cahall, is a singer-songwriter, and I stayed connected with him through that time and sort of drew him more and more into my circle, and he's now living in my house.
And, it's really in your circle.
Yeah, and we're working together pretty closely with a lot of the work that I do whenever I guest preach or that sort of thing. He does the music for the services. And he's got a lot of songs that really look at the hardest parts of life in our world and of his own experience, kind of writes out of his own sorrow and grief. I remember I was listening to him in the car a few years ago and giving a friend a ride, and she said, oh, your music is so depressing. Can we put on something else? And it actually surprised me when she said that. And I realized I'd never thought of it as depressing music, because for me, there's something that art in general can do, but particularly for me, music, of when it looks at the darkest and ugliest parts of our world and of human experience and makes something beautiful out of it. Mm-hmm. That to me is just fundamentally hopeful, and a far stronger source of hope for me than trying to avoid those dark and ugly parts of human experience and pretending like they don't exist, you know, which to me suggests that we're not strong enough to handle them. But when we look directly at them and turn them into beauty, that to me is the real grounds for hope.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. It reminds me of when your friends come at, the first time I ever went to Ireland, I was sitting in a car, you know, and someone was driving, and he said, would you like to hear some traditional Irish music? So I said, sure. So he turned on whatever, and there was this song which was basically, you know, oh, my love, they're taking you away tomorrow on the prison ship, and we'll no doubt starve to death while you're gone, you know? And I was like, oh, my God, that's, like, very... very sad, you know, but there was that strain in the culture, and let's make music about it.
Right. You know? Yeah. And, you know, and I think we used to have that here. You know, my partner, her family lives out in Western Connecticut and has had a farm there for many generations and is still connected to the land there. And her great aunts and great grandparents there, they still sing some of these songs that they sang in their families when they grew up. You know, and some of them are like these songs about dead babies and like joking about it. And I mean, really, really harsh stuff, but it kind of harkens back to that time of life when, you know, when a good number of newborns did die, mm-hmm, and that sort of thing, when life was much harder and they had to find a way to make meaning out of it.
Yeah.
And part of that was turning that heartache into beauty and into joy through those songs.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Wow, this is great. I want to move in. Can I move in too? Well, thanks so much for taking the time to be here today. For everybody who's listening, you can learn more about Tim's work by visiting his website at timdechristopher.org. It's timdechristopher.org.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Join us this summer for the Real Love Challenge. To get your copy of Real Love, visit SharonSalzberg.com. May all beings be happy.